Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you very much for coming out this afternoon. We're very pleased to have this opportunity to do a release of the report, Transforming NATO Again, ahead of the Riga Summit. Michelle Flournoy and Julianne Smith were out in Brussels, 2 weeks ago?
Last week.
Oslo briefing it, and had a brief meeting up on Capitol Hill yesterday, but this is the first time we've had a chance to talk more broadly about it here in Washington. I just want to kick this off, say some words of thanks and of introduction. In particular, we want to thank the Norwegian Institute for Defense Studies, which is one of the main collaborators with us on this report, and also TNO Defense, Security, and Safety, which is part of the Klingendale Center for Strategic Studies. TNO's in The Hague, in any case. Really get ready for this report. Obviously, a lot of discussion about Riga, what the summit is and is not. Really, we're trying to look at the subject of NATO's transformation. In terms of practice, NATO seems to be more global than ever, but in terms of capabilities and institutional arrangements, there's a huge amount more work to be done, and certainly a lot of differences to be bridged. And I think also one of the issues that will crop up in the discussion being led here in a minute by Julie and Michelle are some of the fundamental underlying strategic differences and unresolved problems in the areas of enlargement, mission, and institutional arrangements, in particular the relationship with the EU. And obviously Riga is unlikely to resolve these questions, but it is an important next step in NATO's ongoing transformation, even if we are not sure what the end state is likely to be. In any case, I'd like to thank my two colleagues, Julianne Smith and Michelle Flournoy, for taking the lead here with this project. They released, I think you'll know, a year ago, a report on European defense integration, looking at bridging the difference between strategy and capabilities. So really this is a continuation of their work in this area. In this case, they collaborated, Julie taking the lead on most of the writing, but also with Rolf Tamnes and Sven Melby from Oslo and Stefan de Spiegelier from TNO. This was funded through our initiative for a new transatlantic partnership, which gets funding from EADS and a number of other companies and private foundations. So obviously, I'd like to thank them as well. But let me turn it over to Julie and to Michelle and thank Jim as well for coming here, but I'll let them introduce him. He's a regular participant in our events and delighted you could join us again, Jim. But over to you, Julie.
Thanks, Robin, and thanks to all of you for joining us on a Tuesday afternoon here. We'll try and Michelle and I will give some introductory remarks on the report. We'll allow Jim to provide some commentary, and then we'll certainly be eager to open it up for questions and hear some of your thoughts on the upcoming Riga Summit. So I've had a number of journalists start to call and ask, you know, what is kind of the headline out of Riga? What is the question? What is the core focus of it, if you have to whittle it all down to something. And the one thing I keep telling everybody is there's just one question, and that is, what is NATO for? Is NATO going to be an alliance that is going to primarily focus on collective defense, look inward, focus on Article 5, or is it going to have a more global focus in the future? Are we going to see Afghanistan setting a precedent for future NATO missions and operations, or is Afghanistan going to be viewed as an exception, and then we'll roll back from it depending on the outcome. Of course, NATO has had a hard time struggling with this question for the last couple months, and in fact, really over the last year or so as it's been preparing for Riga. And it's very interesting when you go around the alliance and talk to different missions, different people inside the alliance, depending on what their responsibility is, you can get some very different answers to the question, what is NATO for? And I think that kind of set us off for our framework for writing this report. Now, Riga, I want to give you just a little overview of what we can expect, and I think when I go through some of these items, I think you're going to see that Riga will demonstrate some of the schizophrenia that exists in the alliance today. So what we've done in this report is essentially divide the Riga summit agenda up into three categories. We first look at some of the political transformation issues at hand, the strategic questions, kind of the what is NATO for area. We look a little bit in the report at the actual military capability initiatives that will be launched, and I'll mention those in a minute. And then lastly, we look at current operations, and I'll just say a few words about Afghanistan and leave it at that. So going to the first basket, to the political side of the equation, the comprehensive political guidance will be formally endorsed by heads of states and government. And essentially, NATO tasked itself with writing the CPG a few years ago with the hope that it would help answer this question, what is NATO for, and that would also add some weight behind the commitments that members had already made to strengthen their expeditionary capabilities. But in fact, at the end of the day, for those of you who haven't had the chance to look at the CPG yet, it will be released publicly in Riga. It's a document that's about 5 pages in length. It's quite vague, and it does achieve a couple of different things. The way I describe it is it offers something for everyone. So traditionalists who read the CPG essentially look at it and see that the document itself stresses the importance of NATO's core mission of Article 5, collective defense. For the globalists, those that have a much more ambitious view of where the alliance is headed in the next 5 to 10 years, they'll note that there's also a line in there that says that the alliance should be prepared to undertake a wide range of missions, ranging from peacekeeping, soft security, you could call it, all the way up to high-intensity combat. Now, what happens is, I think at the end of the day, when you read the document, you don't really get the answer as to what NATO's purpose, overarching purpose, should be. But when you take the CPG and combine it with some guidance that came out of a defense ministerial earlier this year in June, I think that the vision becomes a little bit clearer. I think for me, it shows that NATO is ultimately going to move towards the globalist vision, that it will be a more ambitious organization, but that there is going to be some wrangling inside the alliance in the months and years ahead before we can quite get that down on paper. What the defense ministerial guidance does is it talks about the need for the alliance to prepare for 2 major combat operations and up to 6 smaller operations. And I think for me, that puts us in the camp of Afghanistan really serving as a precedent and not an exception. So moving to enlargement, enlargement's going to be featured at the summit as well, and I wanted to say just a few words about that. There are essentially 2 camps inside the alliance on the question of enlargement right now. There are those that are starting to question the rewards of enlargement, that are looking at some of the aspirant countries as security consumers, countries that take, but don't necessarily give, and they're worried about the fact that NATO enlargement could ultimately weaken the alliance's ability to act. The other camp that exists says, yes, enlargement is not easy. It's been challenging on multiple fronts, but at the end of the day, the benefits outweigh any difficulties associated with enlargement. And that, in fact, we've already seen the rewards of adding new members. Several new members, Poland, for example, has already contributed on multiple fronts. So which camp will prevail in Riga? I think in the short term, what we're going to see is that the skeptics will win out. We'll see a watered-down, vague statement on enlargement, that the door remains open. But in the long term, I think what we'll see is eventually the Adriatic Charter members coming into the fold, Macedonia, Albania, Croatia, and that the proponents of enlargement will win out, but probably not until 2008 or 2009. I don't think we'll have specific countries named at the Riga summit, but simply that the door will be left open. Partnerships is another thing I wanted to mention. Here you have some divisions inside the alliance as well. There's the question of what to do with these countries, for example, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Korea, South Korea, who are contributing to NATO missions either financially or militarily, for Afghanistan first and foremost. Certain people, certain countries inside the alliance feel comfortable setting up some sort of formal structure for the alliance so that these countries could ultimately be rewarded for their contributions. Others say we should thank them for their contributions, but we wouldn't want to set up any formal structures because it moves NATO into more of a political arena that we're not comfortable with, and that this ultimately comes back to the question of what is the future of this alliance? Are we looking at a global alliance? Could we envision a day when we would fold these countries into membership? And I think there have been some very heated debates on this question. So again, we're going to see a compromise. I think we will tip our hats and say thank you, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, for all of your wonderful contributions to the mission in Afghanistan, but that we're not really prepared to go much further than that, other than perhaps a joint training program of some kind. But I think it will be modest in terms of how we'll reward these countries. Now, on the capability side of things, kind of the middle section of the report, the capability initiatives, there are a couple things that will come to the surface that I think are notable. If I have to pick one capability initiative in Riga that I think is the most important, it's certainly the acquisition of 4 C-17s. This is part of a new initiative called the Strategic Airlift Capability. These 4 C-17s will be acquired by 2009. 13 nations have come together. I think a few may be added in the days and weeks ahead before Riga, but right now we're looking around a little over a dozen countries that have decided to come together to create this new airlift capability, which in my mind is desperately needed. As you all know, NATO has about 2 feet of documents where they've committed to strengthening their expeditionary capabilities. Lots of commentary, not so much action. So I think many of us are pleased to see the alliance move in this direction of acquiring greater strategic lift. Another interesting development is, but I think certainly not as newsworthy as some of the other items in Riga, is that the NATO Response Force, the NRF, will be declared fully operational, which isn't so much news. I mean, the NRF has been holding now for a couple years at about 17,000 troops. It will officially, we hope, reach the capacity of 25,000 troops, which is important. But there's some very interesting debates going on inside the alliance right now vis-a-vis the NRF. You might remember that the NRF has been used twice to date. It's been used in response to Hurricane Katrina, and it's also been used in response to the earthquake in Pakistan in the fall of 2005. And what happened in both of those cases is that there were certain members inside the alliance that thought, why did we create this, let's call it the Ferrari in the garage, so to speak, for humanitarian missions? Why did we develop this instrument that ideally should be used for high-intensity combat, and we're using it for these softer, small-scale missions? Others have said, why not take it out for a test spin? Why not use the NRF in any way we can agree on? Let's see how it works. And small-scale missions of this kind are ideal because they'll help us prepare for bigger missions. So there isn't any consensus inside the alliance right now on kind of the way ahead for the NRF. And the French in particular have deep reservations about using the NRF for humanitarian missions. And I think there's going to be continued debate on this subject after Riga in particular. Now, I want to mention two things that might creep onto the agenda, but in very subtle ways. You might be aware of the fact that the United States, Italy, and Norway have proposed that NATO create a new training initiative in the Middle East. This would be a small center, could be based at U.S. Central Command, to train a couple hundred defense personnel from countries in the region on a variety of issues, civil-military relations, budgetary issues, defense planning, etc. This, like every other initiative, though, is not without controversy. Some have said NATO certainly excels at training, but we don't believe that training ultimately should be the alliance's core mission in the years ahead. And so there's been some push to pull back this initiative. And I think NATO will task itself to look at the training initiative in the years ahead, but it will certainly not launch a training initiative of any kind in Riga. In a very similar way, there's going to be some developments on stabilization and reconstruction. I think every single member of the alliance clearly understands that we have to do a better job of winning the peace, that today's operations, as we can clearly see, don't end when the combat ends, and that all of us need to do better to develop the type of capabilities that are needed in a reconstruction phase. But that's about where the agreement ends. I think there have been a number of proposals put on the table. Hans Binnendijk and his team have put forward some very interesting and ambitious proposals to create a separate NATO stabilization and reconstruction force. Some more modest proposals have also been put out. Maybe NATO could create stability teams. Maybe they could simply reorganize their forces in one way or another. Again, I don't think this will be settled in the next 2 weeks. What I see is a tasking for the alliance to do some further investigation or to do their homework on this issue. So again, there'll be a couple of interesting initiatives, but none of them terribly formal or cumbersome in structure. Now, I just wanted to say one word about Afghanistan and the current NATO operation there. NATO has over 30,000 troops on the ground in Afghanistan. The mission is incredibly impressive if you think about the complexity of it, the distance from Europe. It certainly would have been unimaginable 10 years ago for NATO to undertake this mission, and I think we should tip our hats and certainly give credit to the alliance for that. But at the same time, as all of you know, and I think this became very clear to me in Brussels last week, the mission in Afghanistan is creating an enormous amount of problems. First and foremost, it's highlighted ongoing capability shortfalls. Secondly, it's exposed ongoing problems with national caveats, and we can get into more detail about that later during the Q&A if you'd like. It's raised some questions about coordination, whether or not the alliance should aim to coordinate when it arrives on the ground, or if it could develop some sort of mechanism to coordinate with civilian organizations before it deploys on a mission. And again, that's certainly an idea not without ongoing and very heated debate inside the alliance. And lastly, I think Afghanistan has really fueled some very thorny debates about NATO's overarching purpose and its roles and missions in the years ahead. And so I think in Riga, we'll see the Secretary General try and put a very happy face on the mission in Afghanistan and say that there'll be a sustained commitment. But I think what we'll see behind some closed doors is some very tense discussions, particularly about the fact that you've got the majority of tasks on the ground are being handled by a minority of the members. Most of you know it's the Canadians, the Brits, and the Dutch that are doing most of the heavy lifting in the south. There's tremendous pressure on other countries, Germany in particular, to do more or bring some of their troops down to the south. So to sum up, I think Riga is not going to be without initiatives and ideas and proposals, but I would call all of them extremely timid. And I think that's not appropriate for the state that we're in vis-a-vis the alliance. I think NATO needs bold ideas and rigorous debate, and I think it's a shame that, in my mind, Riga's going to fall a little bit flat. But I would hope that as the summit wraps up, it's quite clear that there will be two summits in 2008 and 2009, which Michelle will talk about in a minute, and I hope that NATO can use the years ahead to try and bring these two camps, kind of the traditionalists and the globalists, together to kind of chart a common path forward on a number of the issues that I just mentioned. So thank you very much, and I will turn it over to Michelle.
Thank you. The second thing we try to do in this report, besides talk about what will be on the agenda at Riga, is what will not be on the agenda at Riga. What are some of the big strategic issues sitting out there that NATO needs to confront in the near to midterm but will not be fully addressed at Riga? And building on Julie's opening remarks about this existential question of what is NATO for, that the debate about that question has really been sort of papered over in the short term with the CPG. But I think there is a growing sense within the alliance that we really do need to reopen the strategic concept at some point. We're working off an outdated document. In the recent past, both politics and personalities have made a number of people pause and say, well, maybe now is not a good time to reopen that. But I think as NATO heads in towards its 60th anniversary, it's going to be very important to have this strategic debate about fundamental purpose and mission, have that openly and constructively, and try to enshrine the results of that debate in a new and updated concept. It's simply too important to leave the concept to the point where it becomes so outdated that it's irrelevant. It's not a healthy position for the alliance long term. So we would hope that that is something that will come onto the agenda within the next couple of years. The second big issue I'd like to highlight for you is this growing gap between the challenges that NATO's identified for itself militarily and the actual capabilities. And we talked about this a lot in our European Defense Integration Report, but you know, NATO has set for itself the goal of having more rapidly deployable forces, forces able to deploy out of area, forces able to conduct multiple simultaneous missions, highly interoperable, forces adaptable across the full spectrum of operations and so forth. But if you actually take those goals and you look at the actual military capabilities resident in the alliance, there are huge gaps. Now, the problem is if you then look at defense spending, particularly in Europe, the prospects of closing those gaps by continuing on the same path that we've been on is not very good. the only way we're going to close those gaps within the resource constraints that many Europeans countries face is to spend smarter and to pursue a much more integrated approach to defense across the alliance, so that nations are not just optimizing on a national basis, but are really trying to look at collective defense and collective security and optimizing as a whole. And in our, in our earlier work, we proposed four key strategies. One is development of common visions, doctrines, requirements, so that, and we really think NATO has a key role to play, particularly ACT. This is a place where ACT could really be useful to try to bring together different visions and find greater harmonization. Cooperative research, development, procurement. The procurement of the strategic airlift is a great example of that. AGS is another. There are some good examples out there. But again, getting more bang for the buck by pooling investment. Pooling of other capabilities, training, infrastructure for countries that are operating similar systems or see their missions in similar ways. And then finally, for smaller and medium-sized countries, some greater degree of role specialization. One of the things that was really stark when we were in Europe was hearing from CHODs, of some of the chiefs of defense of some of the smaller countries, that they have hit the budgetary wall. They have cut ones and twos out of every capability area as far as they can go. And as one said, I am now facing the question of which capabilities do I allow to go subcritical, meaning which capability areas where I cut, I'm going to lose that capability over time. And I think some of the more courageous CHODs are preparing to go to their parliaments to say, look, if I stay on this trajectory for the next 20 years, I will not have you will not have a viable military. So if that's the plan, let's just cut it now and save lots of money and time and effort getting there. Otherwise, we need a new plan. The problem is that NATO, as an alliance, whether it's ACT, whether it's the defense planning process, is not giving much help to these individual nations as they make these extremely difficult choices and trade-offs. Same CHOD gave me the example of, he'd gone through this laborious analysis process partnering with ACT. They'd made the very tough conclusion that they've got to get rid of certain maritime capabilities. He's ready to step up to his parliament and say, we got to give this up so we can move the investment here. Next week, he gets a call from the ACO, General Jones, that says, I really need you to send five of these things down to the Mediterranean. Now, he got kind of mixed signals from the alliance on, what do they really want from this country? Where do they want them to be going and so forth? So I think one of the other big issues out there is how do we make the NATO defense planning process really valuable for member states who are in, who are in between a rock and a hard place and are struggling to make the right decisions and are not getting clear, not getting a whole lot of help or even help comparing notes with other countries in similar situations. The alliance is not really supporting them in making those tough trade-offs. I also think we need to look at broadening the process to include a broader range of issues beyond traditional defense planning. One example, homeland defense. Many countries are going through a process of trying to figure out how do they leverage military forces in support of a more whole-of-government approach to homeland security. Again, NATO can be a very useful clearinghouse for lessons learned, best practices, and so forth, and comparing of notes needs to step up to that. Another one, civil-military operations. Afghanistan is the test for NATO, but Afghanistan will not succeed or fail based on what happens militarily. It will succeed or fail based on what happens on the civilian side, on the reconstruction side. And NATO, to date, has been very constrained in its development of, in its ability to reach out to other civilian actors, other international organizations, and so forth, because of the political sensitivities of doing so. But if NATO is going to move towards being more of a collective security organization with, conducting out-of-area missions, conducting the full range, including stability ops and so forth, it's got to be allowed to develop the relationships and the understanding and the expertise it needs to be successful, which is to have a much better understanding and set of capabilities for civil military operations. The last topic I want to touch on is this question of strategic partners who will be instrumental to NATO's success in the future. And in the report, we really highlighted two, the EU and Russia. And unfortunately, in both cases, I would venture to say that NATO's relationship with each one is at a very troubled point for different reasons. But in the EU, in the case of the EU, this question over what is NATO for versus what is the EU for and the politics associated with that has really created a great deal of tension, despite the fact that you have overlapping membership for at least for 19 countries. NATO and the EU have so many common interests. They are very different organizations with very different areas of comparative advantage, but they need each other to be effective in the future. And we've got to find out a way for a more constructive and healthy relationship to take root. We recommend in the report a number of small steps, such as reinvigorating the dialogue between the NAC and the EU Political Security Committee, having regular dialogue between the NATO Secretary General and Javier Solano on issues of common interest like counterterrorism, reconstruction operations, and so forth, and then broadening over time into what we really think is needed is a strategic dialogue between the two organizations about what is their view, what are their various views of the future, what is the appropriate sort of way forward for how they want to work together and complement each other in the future. So we hope that this is an issue that will, again, be something that is given more attention beyond Riga. The last example that I'll use is, as I mentioned, NATO-Russia. And I think here again, the relationship is strained because of largely external factors that have occurred with regard to recent developments in Russia and in the near abroad. But Russia remains a critical partner in key areas like nonproliferation and counterterrorism and so forth. And so NATO has a long-term interest in developing a more constructive relationship. One of the things we recommend is really reinvigorating the NATO-Russia Council. You know, I remember when the council was first being formed, and we had great aspirations for what that council would do. And over time, it sort of retreated into its shell, and it's become a place where people come with prepared talking points, which they exchange, and that's sort of it. It needs to become a much more vibrant body for really addressing issues of common interest and common concern going forward. So these are just there are more issues like this in the report, but what we wanted to do is say, understandably, NATO is preoccupied with the present challenges of Afghanistan and other things. Riga will be relatively constrained in its outlook, but the alliance needs to take a much more strategic approach and use the next 2 years to tee up some of these big, big questions that are so fundamental to its vitality and its relevance in the future. Thank you. Let me just introduce Jim. Jim Townsend, many of you know, he is now the director of the International Security Program at the Atlantic Council. But many of us knew Jim as being the leading expert on Europe and NATO in the Office of the Secretary of Defense for many, many years. Just about every U.S. initiative in NATO over the last 15 years came out of this man's head. So, and maybe a few others in the audience. But we are very, very pleased to have Jim with us here today. Thank you.
With a build-up like that, that's a thank you very much. It's great to be here, and it's great to see a lot of good friends out there in the audience. I've also had every one of my talking points taken from me by my two very close colleagues, and which is okay, because you might have seen me dashing some notes down. So I've redone my speech, so you're going to get something very fresh. I was asked to come and provide commentary on the CSIS product. I had to think about the way my wife is when we go off to the movies. If we go off to see a movie dealing with military things or defense things or government things or Pentagon things, where I spent the past 25 years, We sit in the theater and the screen goes up, and I start immediately picking it apart, saying, that doesn't happen. That's not realistic. And usually by the time the movie is halfway over, my wife has grabbed me and thrown me into the aisle, and all the neighbors sitting around us have done the same thing. So when I sat down with the primer there, I was going to do the same thing. It's just pick it apart and have a real slashing presentation here. And I did sit down, unlike you all, I did sit down and I read it from beginning to end, from the acknowledgments all the way to the last recommendation. And I'll have to say, much to my chagrin, when I was done, it's a pretty good piece of work. And I do have some commentary to make, but I'm not going to do that because most of the points I was going to make, in fact, were raised. I will say that particularly on the defense planning sections, which is a lot of what I did at NATO as a defense planner, I went through that, and it's pretty good. So well done to you both and to CSIS for doing this. But I thought what I would do, leaving for the Q's and A's a lot of the detailed discussion on Riga, I, as you just heard, I just left the Pentagon, and I was very much involved in Riga from the very beginning, and so we can certainly talk about a lot of these issues. But I thought for my bit up here, I will tell you a bit about a pit in my stomach when I was finished reading it, and not because I felt the primer was not any good or the content, but I felt that something was missing, and it wasn't, again, part of this product, but something was missing in the way we are approaching summits and the way we are approaching NATO issues. And I say that because I could have sat down, and I think you all could have done that too, and laid out what we felt NATO needed to do in the coming years. And it was too routine, and I know, and I think you all know, and we had a very good discussion before I got here, that there's a feeling of unease out there within the alliance, and I think it's bigger than something that could be fixed by the strategic concept, and that's part of it, obviously. But I felt the same thing when I finished. It was a little too set piece, but I knew there was this bigger problem, and I have been wrestling with this for the past 24 hours as I've been trying to prepare for the presentation, trying to figure out what it is. I think it's something that's bigger than NATO. I think what we were talking about, the questions that Julianne was asking about what is NATO for, she's hearing that. The questions about strategic concept, why we could not sit down today and do a new strategic concept for the Riga summit. These issues, the question, the fact that we find it hard to do a strategic concept in this day and age, is a reflection of the problem. In a sense, it's holding up a mirror to the political problems that are sweeping through the transatlantic community that's bigger than just NATO, bigger than just the EU. But those are the problems that are holding us back from doing things that we feel we need to do to get the alliance in this particular case, but the EU as well, but to get these institutions ready for a future that's so different than what we've seen since they began. I mean, it's obvious things are different. 9/11, the end of the Cold War, but we're beyond that now too. And as I thought about this, Michelle said, obviously I think we need a new strategic concept, and it'd be good timing in 08 or 09 to do it. We would have some big elections out of the way, both in the United States and in Paris and some other places as well, that might give us all a clean slate from which to move. But, as I was thinking about it over the past couple minutes, I don't think that's good enough either. I think it's got to be something more. If I had to put my finger on it, it's almost as if there needs to be a bit of a transatlantic compact between the nations that this is what we want to do and that we all buy into this. I get a feeling sometimes going around the alliance or in Washington too that there's not the buy-in into what NATO is doing or where NATO is going just isn't there anymore, as if some nations are kind of holding their breath and sitting on their hands and not real not feeling at ease about where the alliance could be going in terms of the global missions and this type of thing. And so I think there has got to be some kind of – I remember in London I was in a meeting there and I called it the grand bargain, and I was almost thrown out of the restaurant using that term there. But it's almost as if there has got to be a coming together of the nations in the transatlantic community and coming to an agreement on where it is that we want to go. And once you have an agreement, the roles and missions of the EU and NATO and how they relate to each other and how the United States relates to Europe and vice versa, those will fall into place. There is such paranoia, I think, out there, and there are such misperceptions that have built up over time and have been aggravated by Iraq and these kinds of issues over the past couple of years, that sometimes it's hard to really figure out how a government or a nation feels about where they want NATO to go or what the NATO-EU relationship should be. And I think as we sit down and do a strategic concept, and I did part of the strategic concept back in 98-99 when we were drafting it, it's hard work. And if you don't have at least the foundation set that, in fact, this is what the nations want to do, then you're not going to get a very good strategic concept, no matter how many elections that we've gone past. And so what concerns me is that we have a summit coming up in 08, and we have another one probably in 09. That'll be the 60th anniversary. I can't see us missing out on that opportunity that Leo Michelle remembers so well when we had the 50th. We're going to have to confront these things. We will not be able to come to those summits and not have a strategic concept or have gotten past a lot of these problems. But my feeling is that unless in the next couple of years, before 08 comes on us, before 09 comes on us, that as a transatlantic community, we're going to have to come up with at least a general agreement that this is what we want to do in terms of a broad role for NATO, for the EU, for the relationship between the two, sorting out a bit of the relationship between the United States and Europe and our role in Europe and what the Europeans think about that. I think we're going to have a sorting out, or we're not going to get there from here in terms of answering the questions about whether NATO, answering the questions about a strategic concept. Now, how do you operationalize that? I don't know. I say that knowing having put together a lot of these kinds of things, that's a real recipe for absolute collapse because there's so many nations, and we still have the political problems today that we've referred to here. Paris has one view. Washington has a view. Dublin has a view. And so we have to take that all into account. So how do you do that? Well, you know, we have been kicking around an idea of the so-called Harmel Report. Have you all heard some of this idea? And this was done, of course, in the late 60s. Some wise people got together and sorted out where the alliance needed to go and at that particular point in time. I raised this, or at least Fran Burwell did from the Atlantic Council. We raised this with Toria Nuland last week at NATO, and she was not very happy to hear even that. But the idea really, I think, is this, that it's not a matter, I think, of convening a big convention somewhere with delegates and hangers-on and media and expectations and ending up with nothing but a communique. I think it is a matter of getting a subset of Europe, of transatlantic leaders, past, present, and future, together, a smaller group to try to sort some of this out. And see if there can be general agreement. Now, I'm throwing this out as something that is just absolutely won't work. It might very well not. But I do think that we cannot wait on the U.S. government or on other Atlantic governments, North Atlantic governments, to come up with a way ahead. They are too busy doing a myriad of things, Iraq notwithstanding. I do think, though, that the think tanks here in Washington, and I was talking to Mr. Hamry, walking down here from the Atlantic Council, we saw each other on the street. I do think that the think tanks in Washington might want to take on this, at least think it through, NDU, some of the others, and think through how we might be able to prepare the way at least for that time when we have a strategic concept, prepare the way so that NATO and the EU can come up with a way in which they can work well together. I don't think we're going to get there unless we do something like this. So I'm going to end it there. You see what happens when you depart from your notes. And then we can talk about the Riga Summit, too. Thank you.
Well, we have time. Thank you, Jim. We have time for some questions. Who would like to jump in first? Yes, Harlan.
First, thanks for a really good briefing. I haven't read the report, but I look forward to doing that. A fair and a less fair question. The less fair question. Write the headline that you'll see in the newspapers after Riga and tell me what page you're going to think it's going to be on. And second, one of the problems that Jim talks about this, we don't seem to have a spark plug or a real advocate for NATO, either on the Hill or in any of the European capitals or here. Do you agree with that, and what do we do about it if you do?
All right, I think I'll give myself a minute to think for my answer, and I'll take another question. Yes. In the back, did you have a question? No, okay. All right, well, then maybe we'll jump in. I guess I'll go with my so my headline, my nomination for the headline would probably be first of all, it's going to fall far back with A24 or A25 in the post, I'm sure. Well, who knows? But depending on what happens in Afghanistan in the next 2 weeks, I think it will ultimately be tied to Afghanistan. NATO reaffirms commitment or bolsters mission in Afghanistan. There'll probably be some effort to put, again, a somewhat happy face on the mission. But I think if there's a reporter that's determined to find some sort of bad news, there could be a gloomy spin on it as well. I don't know how it'll play out. We're trying to brief some reporters on this side before they fly over. In terms of the spark plug or the champion, where is the champion for NATO? You know, on this side of the Atlantic, it's hard to find him. They're few and far between. There aren't as many members, I think, on the Hill who hold NATO near and dear to their hearts. There's certainly some of the big heavy hitters on the Foreign Relations Committee or the HIRC. But on the other side, I actually have been taken aback by Merkel and her commitment to NATO and some of the statements she's made at Verkunde, some of the other security conferences. I thought the German white paper that recently came out, I thought that was a pretty strong message vis-a-vis NATO. Of course, it was very supportive of the EU at the same time, but I felt like there's just a little bit of an edge given to NATO for, you know, the primary focus of security and defense. So, you know, that would be one. I mean, Aznar is out there, you know, proposing that NATO take in lots and lots of new countries all around the world, including some in Latin America and beyond. There's certainly no shortage of ambitious ideas, but in terms of spark plugs or champions, I guess I'd put Merkel down on my list. Michelle or Jim? Headlines?
Well, I think you've asked exactly the right question, framed just the right way. I would say, what will be the headlines in the European press? What kind of play will they get? I think obviously, you know, we've seen over time how the headlines and the articles are in the back pages in Europe as well as here, and that's a pity in a lot of ways, because one of the important points about even having a summit for NATO is that it gets out into the public eye the fact that there is NATO, that these nations belong, and that makes the heads of state and government as well get their head engaged on being part of the alliance. And as you know, within the European Union, heads of state and government meet pretty frequently. And so it's something where NATO meets every 2 years at that level. And so, you know, the pity would be that it's not a reminder also to European and American publics, too, that the alliance is there. I think the advocacy point of view might be helped out if NATO proves that it becomes a very relevant tool for the problems coming up that we will be facing. Afghanistan, as we all say, is a test case. If NATO has really proven, as it did in the Balkans, that it can be a real force for helping solve a lot of problems, or at least a tool to be used as many tools are used on a problem, advocates will appear because they realize how important it is to have that ability when a crisis comes. And I think that's one thing that Afghanistan will help us build is this advocacy. Coming from the Atlantic Council, who are the advocates for the North, for the Atlantic community and for NATO, I can tell you we're like the Maytag repairmen, you know. And one of the reasons I went there was to try to pump up and clean that spark plug and get us going. And it's interesting, you know, there are Atlantic Council chapters in all the NATO capitals, and the one in Turkey, I was told, has two people in it, and they're both over 80 years old. So you see, there's a lot of missionary work that's got to be done. So there you go. Michelle.
Enough said.
Yeah, Robin, and then Anne.
Thanks very much for those presentations. The strategic concept obviously was the main focus, I think, of all of your comments, and the desire to try and find a common perception of how NATO goes forward. You also touched on enlargement, or a little less on enlargement. Enlargement came up as one of the strategic questions. I suppose my question is the following. What is the linkage between enlargement and defining a new strategic concept? In other words, does the enlargement debate, the possibility of that becoming a defining aspect of 2009, especially if you have the open door reaffirmed here in 2006, does that start to define what the strategic concept can or cannot be? If enlargement takes us in directions of Ukraine and so on, that could have a very different impact on the relationship between consumers and suppliers of security and on the whole definition of what NATO may be about from a strategic standpoint. If it isn't such a big issue on the table, then maybe global NATO looks strong. So how do you see the connection, the interconnection between enlargement and the strategic concept?
Great. Anne, do you have a question? You want to jump in as well?
As per usual, I have three questions. I'd like to grade now retiring Sakur Jimmy Jones and to give us, also to Hab Schupper, if you could give us a grade card and how well he's worked with Jimmy Jones or not. And then lastly, as you discussed, Aznar has been sort of talking about everybody, including, who knows, Venezuela joining NATO, but in particular, the role of Israel and whether or not Israel plays a role, particularly as the new strategic relationship has been established with NATO. So three unrelated, long-winded questions, probably with long answers. So.
If I could jump in on Robin's very good question, and I have to say I went through about three different answers in a nanosecond as you were talking with describing the question. In 1998, 1999, we were doing the strategic concept then. So much of what shaped that strategic concept was the experience in the Balkans. And when you read it, you really see that. Now, enlargement had begun, obviously. We had the Partnership for Peace. We had just brought in three new nations, brand new, when the strategic concept was agreed at the Washington summit. I think, though, as we look at doing another strategic concept, your point would manifest itself definitely in a tension at the table between those new allies and their perceptions of themselves and what they see NATO doing for them. So on a very personal, you know, basis, in a sense, for a nation, for the person sitting at the table. And where the maybe where some of the other larger allies, not all of them, but some of them might want the alliance to go in terms of a global look. We hear the tension already where some nations are saying, I mean, put the ideology aside of what NATO should be, just focused on Europe and Article 5 and that type of thing. But where some of the new allies particularly are concerned that NATO's gaze is going much broader and there are problems at home in the, on the European continent that they would like NATO to pay more attention to. We already hear that line. And I think when you sit down to write the strategic concept, you will have that tension in the debate. Obviously dependent on how strong the new allies want to push and can play at the table on that. There will be a lot of arm twisting and all of a sudden nations throwing their weight around. So, but I think enlargement will definitely bring a different kind of tension in the views of nations on the role of NATO and how that impacts their own security versus what we saw in 1999.
We're here to talk about the alliance. I'd rather not get into the personalities. I think the only thing I would say about Jones and Hub Schupper, I mean, I think they've both been very honest about the problems at hand. I think their comments have been frank at every turn. And I think they've tried to think of innovative ways to look at things like national caveats and many of the issues that have been associated with the mission on the ground in Afghanistan, or many of the challenges that are associated with that mission. So I would certainly give kudos to them for not brushing things under the rug. I think they come straight up. They're happy to tell you the things that NATO's really been successful at in the last few months and years, but they're also very upfront with some of the continuing challenges, and I respect that, and I think in many ways that approach is just right. Israel, I mean, that comes back to the question here that Robin's posed, and I think the fundamental question here that could be sketched out in a strategic concept is, you know, what is it that NATO needs versus what NATO provides? And that is NATO there to provide an incentive for reform, for modernization, for transformation for these new members? Or is it in need, is it an alliance in need of new capabilities and partners, and so it has to go seeking for additional capabilities, especially if, as Michelle pointed out, some of the efforts to acquire those capabilities are grinding to a halt inside Western Europe in some cases. So I think getting at the heart of the strategic concept and opening up that Pandora's box will also bring out, as Jim mentioned, the enlargement debate, which is directly tied to it. So for me, it's there's no question that the two are linked.
At the risk of talking about personalities, I'll just comment on General Jones's performance. I actually think that in a very low-key way, he's gone after a lot of really critical issues and made some real progress. I think, you know, the NRF, whatever you think about the debate about its use, it is a real capability. It's a capability that NATO didn't have before, and I think he's also used the NRF to help individual Chads use the NATO card to push their own domestic constituencies to do more for transformation and building up needed capability. I also think by putting things like common operational funding on the table, I think that's critical for the alliance being viable militarily in the future. So I actually think that, you know, he hasn't been a headline grabber, but that's not his style. He's worked very effectively behind the scenes to push at a lot of the critical capability issues, and I think he deserves a great deal of credit for that. You know, the one thing I would say on the strategic partnerships issue, whether it's Israel or Australia or what have you, you know, I think we can overreach in terms of formalizing these things. I think when you formalize some of these things, it's not clear in everybody's mind, well, why are we doing this and what are we trying to say and so forth. And the truth is, many of these countries work very closely and very effectively with NATO in the field, and we're doing just about everything we want to do with them already. It's not clear to me that they are asking for a formalized partnership or that we need a formalized partnership to continue to work on issues of interoperability or to have joint training and exercise or to work together on the ground in operations. I mean, I'll just tell you, I won't name names, but a little, you know, anecdote that I think there are some in the Australian military who really had no interest in being certified by NATO, you know, in terms of their capability. So they're like, fine, thank you very much. We love to work with NATO. We're happy to work with NATO, but we, you know, we don't need a formalized process. So I think it's worth asking why, you know, what is that additional formalization bias at this point?
And I guess I really should jump in and because I was there when it was built, tell you a little bit exactly answer that question. When this started off, and it was in June of a year ago, June, sitting around the table there at Truman Hall, the idea really was that we could probably all benefit, Australia as well as NATO, with looking at ways in which particularly Australia and NATO forces could have better interoperability, where there are communications problems, where there are some deployability issues, were there some need to do some exercises together to make sure that NATO forces and, say, Australia or other nations too could perform even better on the battlefield. And I think what Michelle said is right. It's not that we weren't, but were there some areas where maybe in the special operations arena or some other ways, maybe the air forces, where there's some, you know, doing close air support, obviously you need to be quite familiar with each other to do that. So we wanted to look for that kind of thing. And so it started off really as a military partnership where, as I used to say, you'd see someone with an Australian bush hat in shape at Mons, no one would do a double take because they had an office down there and they'd be doing lots of work with NATO and STANAGs and whatever. And we wouldn't worry about any kind of certification, that kind of thing, although that did crop up later on. Some people were talking about that, which is absolutely not where we were. As what happens with so many good ideas, this was taken and it began to be elaborated on. Pretty soon it was global partners and it was political and we absolutely lost control of the issue and it became what it is today. So what I have been asking allies to do is I say, look, you know, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater here. At Riga, just if you could have hesitating government task the alliance to keep working on this issue, but ask the NATO military authorities to begin to look at it from a military interoperability point of view. Are there some areas where it might do us some good to have better interoperability with nations that we might find ourselves working with? And we could identify those and just work on those in a discrete way. So we'll see what happens at Riga at the end of the day, but that was how it all began.
Christoph von Marschall, I'm the Washington correspondent of the German daily, Der Tagesspiegel. I would like to ask a little bit more about Afghanistan and really about Frank Wirtz, how the situation is over there. How is your reading, your perception of the situation? Because I'm a little bit confused. In the last 2 weeks, there were visiting experts from Britain and Germany, and they seem to describe the situation that NATO is in danger to lose a military battle. But here I heard from Michel that it's not about the military problem, it's rather about reconstruction. What is the right description of the situation? Is the situation deteriorating? And if this is true, can we have a situation resembling Iraq in next summer, something like that? Then everybody seems to criticize at the moment the Germans that they're not going to the south, but they're needed over there. Well, in Germany we have a public discussion that seems to describe the situation that we are not there, but from visiting German politicians, I hear here, well, the Germans are already in the south, 50. So are our politicians lying to our public? What are your information? But really, I would like to learn a little bit more, because if it's really about deteriorating in Afghanistan, then we will have a very different discussion than about a future strategic papers and so on. Then we have a huge political problem if NATO is not delivering in Afghanistan.
Let me clarify my remarks. I did not mean to suggest that the military situation was easy. I do believe that things are deteriorating fairly rapidly in terms of the security situation. What I was saying is that even if we were to turn that around, that still wouldn't be – that would be necessary but not sufficient to ultimately achieve our goals in Afghanistan. So the security piece is the sine qua non. With it, almost anything is possible. Without it, nothing is possible. So I think you're absolutely right. We need to worry about the security situation. It is not going in the right direction at the moment, and I think that's one of the issues that NATO will be grappling with at Riga. But even beyond focusing on new commitments in the military arena, what is even more disturbing to me longer term is that the reconstruction effort is very ad hoc, very piecemeal, not coordinated. I mean, it's being done by PRTs that have different objectives, approaches, strategies in different areas, very little coordination, very little focus on how are we really going to empower a central government that's never really been accepted in Afghanistan's history. So I think the immediate problem is trying to stabilize the military situation and improve it. But the longer-term problem is how are we going to make reconstruction successful and sustainable there?
Yeah, I would just say Germany specifically. I have not been to Afghanistan. I've spoken with a lot of people on the ground who have just returned. My impression is that the call for Germany to move to is around the order of 1,000 or more, that they'd like to see German troops move down. So there may very well – I'm not aware of the fact that there are 50, some say 25 to 75 Germans down in the south, but that's not what's being – the request is a very heavy presence, that Germany would in fact shift. I fully understand, having lived in Germany for many years, the political constraints to doing so, but the call from the countries that are down there right now, from the Dutch, Canadians, and the Brits in particular, is for Germany to have a much, much more substantial presence in the south. But I think Michelle's exactly right. I mean, I think on the military front, it doesn't seem to be going terribly well at the moment for multiple reasons. I mean, first and foremost, we're clearly losing the public diplomacy. Hearts and minds has been thrown out the window, particularly particularly in the South. The question of poppy eradication and whose job that is, that continues to spin around in just about every organization out there. Is it individual countries? Is it NATO? Is it the EU? Is it the World Bank? Is it the UN? I mean, you can go through just about everybody on the grounds having this debate. What do you do about the fact that they're having a bumper crop? I mean, there doesn't seem to be any consensus on who should be handling this and how we should be handling it. And then, of course, as Michelle pointed out, the reconstruction piece. I mean, there's very, very strong push. I was surprised when I heard the Secretary General speak in Brussels last week how much of his speech was dedicated towards the EU's role in all of this, that as an institution that is supposed to be the beacon for soft security missions, peacekeeping, humanitarian, reconstruction, that really is leaps and bounds in many ways above the United States, for example, it is not simply stepping to the plate right now. And that if we don't get all of these pieces right, if we don't focus on hearts and mind, on the reconstruction, on the military, if it doesn't come together in this kind of winter pause that we're hoping will arrive soon, then we're going to be in real trouble come spring. And what you hear from the Canadians and the Dutch in particular is we're not sure how long this mission is sustainable for us. You know, our publics are asking us, we're losing guys all the time. The question is, why aren't there other NATO members down there with you? Who's going to share the burden over the next 5 to 10 years as we continue to operate on the ground?
Just the point that there's going to be a problem in a year when it's time to do the new rotations down in the South. It's a very practical problem. NATO always has it in a force generation conference setting. When the rotations are up, we got to find others to go down there. And so not all allies are capable of going down, whether deployable or are their forces necessarily sustainable or can handle the kind of missions down there. The reason there's a lot of pressure on Germany, and Germany has been pulling a good share of the load up in the north. There's no doubt about that. And there's no criticism implied of Germany on this. It's just that we're going to have trouble finding the right kinds of deployable, sustainable forces in to go down there in 2 years' time. But we're going to have to start the force generation conferences to start filling those gaps in at least a year. And so I've talked to many of my German colleagues who've come through town, and I know there is a debate going on, and they echo as well that they've got to have this debate, because where they are now in terms of the courts and this type of thing is that going into that kind of combat situation is iffy. And my plea has been that they not wait to have that debate when the pressure's on even more than it is now. And so we'll see where things end up in a year.
Other questions? I can't quite see around here. Yes.
If NATO continues to pursue enlargement of enrollment and mission set, is there a point at which things get a little messy vis-a-vis the United Nations and who's supposed to do what? Pragmatically, NATO has certain advantages over the United Nations, but isn't the United Nations. And at what point do they start to get a little messy about who does what?
We'll take two. Take this other one that I can't see. Sorry.
Thanks. Two quick ones. Do you think that the situation with European American or NATO EU cooperation will improve after the April presidential elections in France? And secondly, assuming very optimistically that NATO does develop some sort of soft global role, interoperability with Australia, with Japan, is the U.S. configured to actually engage with that? Can we make our UCP seams work? Are we really going to have a peacekeeping a mission in PACOM? I'm the pole at Striking Force NATO. My new British deputy two-star, when the resolution came out about North Korea, jumped up and said, "This is great. Let's get NATO to do the command and control for an embargo mission off North Korea." To which I responded, "You haven't been in NATO very long, sir, have you?" But it raises the valid point. Would PACOM accept that? How would we organize it? You know, are we flexible enough to be a good global NATO member?
Michelle, Jim, anybody? Any takers?
And also the UN, too. I mean, that's a good question, too, that actually NATO has wrestled with now for a while. But let me start off with the PACOM issue and the U.S. and our – the way we're organized, being a good global NATO ally. A couple things. One is, when I was sitting at NATO a few years ago, the idea that NATO would even be in Afghanistan working alongside Australians as well as a U.S.-led coalition in the East and that type of thing. I mean, talk about a crazy quilt of command arrangements and personalities and nationalities. You know, the idea when I was sitting at NATO that we would do this is absolutely – you would have been laughed out of room two there at NATO. And yet we've done that. And so the idea of NATO providing command and control for an allied or some type of UN mission or some type of maritime interdiction force off of North Korea, I no longer say that something like that is out of the question. It could very well be. In fact, when the call went out for some kind of plus-up for the UNIFIL forces in Lebanon happened, I was expecting NATO to be rolling in with at least a command and control. Now, that's a whole another question, which actually should be looked at. But so my bottom line is this. I think, yes, the U.S. would be because we have been able to adapt ourselves and be flexible about it. I think that kind of role for NATO halfway around Europe is something that I think NATO could take on if the political will was there to do it. I think the answer is yes. It might strike some in PACOM who can't even spell NATO, like, who are these guys? But at the end of the day, the alliance taking on a mission like that and bringing the allies along with it and the political support for it is helpful to PACOM. It's something PACOM doesn't have to do. We'll be contributing some ships to it, and maybe we'll have our own maritime task force steaming around too. But it's something that I think we could make work, and I think it's something that we're more used to doing now. So that's it. On the United Nations, allies, to include the United States, I think would prefer to have a UN Security Council resolution supporting whatever mission NATO is taking on. And as you know, NATO has told the UN that if the UN needs to turn to NATO to take on a mission, like, as I said, was Lebanon, NATO has already agreed years ago that it would be available to do that if the allies agree and all that kind of thing. So there is definitely a relationship between NATO and the UN, both in terms of the two institutions as well as between allies wanting to have that UN seal of approval before going off and doing something. Now, I will say, of course, the Kosovo Air Campaign did not have that UN seal of approval, and there was a lot of pretzel wording to try to, you know, make it what it turned out to be, because there were problems in the UN Security Council brought on by one of the UN members that didn't allow that to happen. But nations knew it needed to the killings in Kosovo needed to stop, and NATO was going to go in and do that. So I think NATO established point that it wants to have that UN Security Council resolution. It wants to have that UN support, and allies, some by law, have to have it. But at the end of the day, if there is a crisis of such magnitude where allies at the NAC say we need to go do this, and for whatever reason the UN can't make its view known, I think the alliance has that door open to do that. But at the end of the day, that is not the way in which allies nor NATO want to operate. There is a relationship, and there is a hierarchy that is well respected, and that's the environment within which NATO likes to operate.
I guess the only thing we haven't addressed is the French elections. My take is we just don't know. I mean, we're going to see how that plays out. One could imagine it improving, just due to elections both in France and in this country. I mean, there's no secret that we've got two countries that are not really holding hands and walking off into the sunset right now, prepared to really expand the EU-NATO relationship in many different directions. And I would hope, I mean, it's unclear, but I would hope that given some new personalities brought into the mix in the years ahead, that could open up the door for some new ideas to be put on the table.
And what I would say, very, very similar to that, too, is that we don't know, though, at the end of the day. And in fact, Julianne and I were just talking about this before our panel began, and that is there is an assumption out there that once Chirac leaves the scene, and President Bush, of course, there will be an election, there will be a new personality, Democrat or Republican, on the scene here, and other elections, too. There will be new personalities. There will be an opportunity for a clean slate, but I've never seen it in the past be as clean as that. And we don't know, too, and within the within the French elites or within the Quai d'Orsay or among others that shape policy in France, whether the Chirac view or a variant of it, in fact, is something that's popular. I mean, we don't know. I mean, a lot has happened over the past couple of years to strain this perception of each other, France and the United States, or France and its aspirations for Europe and for the EU and for NATO. So I think we'll just have to see. And it goes back to my original comments up there that I don't think it's going to be as easy as we would like it to be by having some elections take care of the irritants and we can sit down and once again come together as the big family we know we are. And you know, I don't think it's going to be that easy. And I think that elections may help, may not. But as I say, I do believe there needs to be a compact out there between now and these summits coming up above the NATO-EU level, maybe a small group that gets together and comes up with something. So no matter what happens in the elections, we can at least see fit to work out a relationship between NATO, between the EU, the United States, and the players that seem to be at odds today.
Okay, I think we're running out of time. Maybe we'll take one last question if there is one in the back.
Thank you. We haven't talked much about another side of the whole expansion part of NATO, which is in the Istanbul Cooperative Initiative part of the Mediterranean Dialogue part, not really in terms of membership, but in terms of expanding influence. This has got both to do with the political aspects of it as well as the sort of strategic mission of it. I wonder if you might comment, first of all, how the Riga Summit might or might not address this potentiality, and where you think recommendations, I don't know if your report gets into this, might play into how NATO could make the most of that region. Thanks.
Well, we do mention that in the report. Sorry, I didn't go over. I skipped Special Forces and BMD and some of the other things. But we do talk about two sides of the partnership debate. I mentioned kind of what to do with the Australia-New Zealand-Japan combination. But there is a portion of the report that talks specifically about this alphabet soup. You've got the EAPC, the MD, the ICI, the list goes on and on. And I think what we're probably going to see at this, I mean, Jim knows better than I do, but my guess is probably some sort of effort to step back and conduct an audit of some of these partnerships, streamline some of them, outline the criteria. I mean, we keep slapping on new partnerships, but I think everyone recognizes inside the alliance that it is time for a bit of a reassessment, particularly as some of these have faded in and out over the years. Obviously, P4P was front and center. Now that it has a lower profile than it did, say, five years ago. So in our report, we talk about the necessity, and we would support an audit of sorts, but also some questioning inside the alliance about the ultimate value of these partnerships. I mean, do you partner for partnership's sake? You know, is it simply valuable to have a conversation and a dialogue with countries in the Middle East, no matter what, even if you don't find yourself in a position where, or the alliance doesn't find itself in a position where concrete agenda items are being pushed through? So I think there's some questioning on our side, particularly as NATO aims to partner or already does partner with some countries with some rather dicey human rights records and what the ultimate goal of some of those partnerships are. So it is certainly in there, and I'm thank you for bringing it up. But maybe Jim has another perspective on that. I don't know if you want
to. I was going to let you handle that
okay. No, you don't feel
like no, I think and something interesting. You know, The Mediterranean Dialogue and ICI, but just Mediterranean Dialogue, there's a bit of a north-south split at NATO, and not surprising. The southern allies have perspectives and concerns that are more rooted towards Mediterranean and North Africa, Middle East, than those in the north. And so when Mediterranean Dialogue issues used to come up, I have a great story about a communique drafting session once, but I'll spare you the story. But there is a lot of effort being made to use these Med Dialogue and ICI too tools by the Southern Allies to do small programs. And I think a couple things. One is a lot of times we don't hear or see this. I mean, going back to the headline question about Riga. Yeah, headlines don't come out of the Med Dialogue. Maybe they do in some of the regional papers in Southern Europe. But there are things going on down there that actually are very important in trying to improve a lot of the regional relations down in the south and around the Mediterranean area. I mean, Israel is part of that, too. We had a question earlier about Israel.
And the ICI is being slower off the mark, but that's understandable because we're really dealing with some very complex relationships and a lot of historic baggage down there as well. But one thing that I did find interesting over the past year, as we began to realize the work that had to be done between in terms of the perceptions on the street, so to speak, between those nations that make up in the Middle East area and then the Gulf area and Europe, that the ICI all of a sudden became more important. And what was interesting was that NATO was relieved that they already had in place a program agreed to by heads of state and government in Istanbul that could be used. It would have been maybe politically difficult to create that today, but they had something where NATO could try to do something to help deal with this perceptions issue between the nations of Europe and the nations further to the south and east. So these are small programs. We're not going to hear a lot out of them. We're not going to see a lot out of it at Riga for sure, but I believe that they're going to get a bit bigger going into the future, and I think they are actually doing some very good things right now in a limited way. But I'm not so sure that should surprise us, that this is something that's going to have to grow over time. But they are getting more attention now than they used to back in the late 90s, early 2000.
I think we're going to have to wrap up. I just want to thank all of you for coming, and especially thanks to Michelle and Jim for joining us today. Thanks so much.